Hi, I'm Allison Kubo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Well, the signs on Main Street promoting the 2022 Sundance Film Festival are still up, but this weekend was pretty quiet here in Park City. It's not supposed to be that way. Like so much in the last 2 years, the COVID virus was cited as the cause for the festival to go virtual for the second year in a row. But while the crowds dressed in black and smoking cigarettes may not be overwhelming our restaurants and hotel, much of the business of Sundance goes on. Sundance is perhaps the most important showcase for independent films in the nation. And for filmmakers, the business of Sundance is all about getting distributed.
So how does the business of independent filmmaking work? How do films get made if there's no assurance of any kind of back-end revenue? What are the economics of making an independent film? Who buys films at Sundance, and how do they decide what they are worth? And what happens to all those documentaries? We are so lucky this morning to welcome back one of our favorite guests, Professor Peter Desherny of the University of Pennsylvania. Peter, welcome to Mountain Money this morning.
Thank you, Allison Rogers. Nice to be back.
So let's start by discussing the differences between how the type of independent film we see at Sundance is financed and made versus the typical major studio production we see released in the theaters.
Sure. So the Hollywood studios each make one or two dozen movies a year, mostly superhero movies or animated films. And then non-studio films are made by production companies that try to sell their films to distributors. Studios are also distributors, and they sometimes have what are called first look or right of refusal relationships with some production companies. And then there are companies that are both production companies and distributors. But basically, production companies come to Sundance looking for distributors, and the market gets started actually as soon as the Sundance lineup is announced. So even before the first film is shown, there are deals happening. It's in part about sharing the risk. So if a film seems to get a thumbs up from the festival programmers or juries or audiences or another distributor, a company is more likely to take a chance on it. And actually that question of like what's an independent film versus what's a studio film has become much murkier since Sundance's kind of early days in the 1980s and 1990s. And I think today we'd ask, is Amazon or Netflix a major studio? And there's more and more vertical integration like Comcast acquiring NBC Universal or Apple getting into film production. So as the landscape becomes increasingly complex, that studio indie line, that binary seems less relevant. But in the end, I think that complexity actually creates more opportunities for filmmakers to make films and distribute them. And it creates more diverse content for audiences.
So that's interesting. Talk a little bit more about how an Amazon or a Netflix blurs the line between an independent film. I mean, are Amazon and Netflix now financing their films up front?
So they do sometimes finance films up front. Most of the time they're acquiring film. Just to put it in perspective, Netflix spent about $17 billion on acquisitions last year. And so they're definitely not a small independent player in the way we're used to thinking about it.
So let's talk a little bit about the kinds of expenses that an independent filmmaker has to bear. I mean, you have this vision of, you know, three young people with a camera and a video box making a movie in their backyard. What does it cost? But the films we see at Sundance are obviously far more sophisticated and polished than that. What kind of money does it cost to make an independent feature film? And how do these people put it together to get it done?
Yeah, so there's really a huge range of films at Sundance. There are narrative features and shorts. There are documentaries. There are the immersive experiences in the New Frontiers section of the festival. On one end of the spectrum, a true shoestring documentary might cost as little as $100,000. Actually, most of the shorts probably cost more than that, too. But then there are also narrative feature films with big stars that can cost tens of millions. But as you would expect, the expenses cover everything from film crew to equipment to post-production to food. There's also a pretty wide range of how long it takes for a film to be made. So it's not unusual for a script to bounce around for 5 or 10 years until all the constellations arrive. It's what people call development hell. And then there are documentaries that can take years and years to tell stories that unfold over a long time. Just for example, if I can use an example, I really love the Macedonian documentary Honeyland that premiered at Sundance in 2019. Really beautiful film about a beekeeper in a remote area taking care of her aging mother and protecting her hive. I think it took 3 years to make. They shot hundreds of hours of footage, but it was almost entirely made by two filmmakers camping out by the subjects, all shot on DSLRs. It's really as close to a no-budget film as you can get. So Honeyland ended up with 3 Sundance Awards, and the distributor Neon picked it up for the theatrical distribution in the U.S. It made well over $1 million theatrically, which is a huge margin for any film. So that's obviously kind of an outlier, but it's exactly the kind of story that always fuels the Sundance myth, from no budget to festival darling to big box office success.
So you started going into the distributors, and those are typically the companies that come to Sundance to look for films. Can you again give us just maybe more of a sense of the kinds of distribution channels they represent? And then as well, how do they determine what a film is worth? Because truly that's, I think, what the filmmakers are looking for as well.
Yeah. So there are several different kinds of distributors. There are theatrical distributors like Neon or A24 or Roadside Attractions, who are looking either to U.S. theatrical distribution or international theatrical distribution. There are video on demand companies like iTunes or a cable company. And then the big players increasingly are the streamers like Amazon, Hulu, Discovery Plus, Apple. Rights are also sold by geographic region. And increasingly worldwide. So multiple companies might buy different bundles of rights for one single film. And don't underestimate the value of theatrical distribution. For larger films, in pre-pandemic times at least, a full half of the domestic revenue could come from theatrical ticket sales. That's obviously been in flux over the past couple of years. Theatrical releases are also important for marketing, and the promise of a theatrical release can be very enticing to filmmakers. Netflix bought a theater in New York specifically for that purpose. But really, as you're asking us about the prices, it's the competition among streamers that's really been the main driver of prices. As a result, one trend now is for the theatrical distributors and streamers to team up just because it's too expensive for them to do it independently. So Hulu and Neon did this, and Apple and A24. I think it's very likely we're going to see a lot more consolidation ahead.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because a theatrical release, I can, you know, make an educated guess as to what my revenues are going to be from a nationwide theatrical release and base my price based on some kind of, you know, mathematical analysis of that. I would think for the streamers, it's more complicated because the analysis of what kind of a film is likely to attract monthly subscriber eyeballs has got to be really tricky. And yet, I mean, they are buying films for lots of money.
Exactly. So Coda, as you know, was one of the big sales last year that was bought for $25 million. It ended up earning just $1 million theatrically, although that actually still puts it ahead of some of the other big sales last year, which was like Nicole Beckwith's Together Together, or Rebecca Hall's Passing, which was on Netflix. So the streaming platforms are overspending right now because they want to attract subscribers, of course. But there's a lot else in the calculations, as you suggested. They also want to build their brand. So just 2 years ago, Apple had no reputation as a film company. So it can be worth a lot to kind of bake in public perception of the brand now. Apple launched, you might remember, initially with films and shows by well-known filmmakers and stars, which is an age-old Hollywood formula. They also had a lot of duds, which is not atypical. And they've been trying to make up for it with festival acquisitions. So, yeah, lots of different pieces rather than just the number of eyeballs or ticket sales.
And they certainly promoted Coda very heavily on Apple as a, I guess, as a means to try to attract eyeballs. Talk a little bit about another acquisition last year that was interesting was the Summer of Soul documentary. Really interesting film that was picked up by Hulu. Again, would Hulu have thought that that's a film that would drive prestige or eyeballs? Again, I thought it was unusual that they would shell that kind of money out for a documentary.
Yeah, so Sundance is largely responsible for broadening the popular market for documentaries since the 1980s. There are a lot of documentaries that actually really make money and find large audiences, partly because Sundance created this market. And the competition just gets tighter and tighter. I think last year only about 2% of documentaries were accepted. There are a lot of reasons why Summer of Soul was appealing. So Summer of Soul was made by Questlove, who already has a large following. And that's what studios would call a kind of pre-sold audience. It features performances by important and still popular musicians. But then it won the Grand Jury Prize and Audience Award at Sundance. And then tons of awards at other festivals. And that's a sign that both critics and audiences liked it. It's also a music film, and that also helps it to have a broader global appeal. And I think actually that's a key piece of its value. So as you know, it was picked up by Searchlight Pictures, and then it had a theatrical, which only made about $500,000 domestically. Then it was on Hulu, where it was definitely promoted heavily. But then it actually had a large global distribution by Disney. So Disney released it on its Hotstar streaming platform in India and on its Star Plus Latin American platform. And then actually back to branding, Hulu has been developing a reputation for having great documentaries for years. So this fits a category and audience that they're trying to consistently target and keep.
And here I thought all it did was rerun all TV shows.
So you've been referencing other festivals and, you know, you've talked about films that are receiving awards at Sundance. Can you give us a sense of the landscape of the different festivals? What is the importance of Sundance? I know it's the first of the year and first festival of a calendar year. What does Sundance bring that, you know, maybe other festivals don't? Why is it important or relevant?
Yeah, so as you suggest, there are just so many festivals. In some ways, I like to think now the festival market has kind of replaced the art house market, which has largely disappeared. And so a film that goes to Sundance, you know, Sundance, as you said, is one of the first festivals. It really helps set the tone. So a film that goes to Sundance might actually be on the festival circuit for the full year, and a lot of other festivals follow Sundance's lead.
Are you still there, Peter?
I'm still here. Sorry, okay. Can you hear me?
Yes. Okay. Yep.
You were saying, were you finished when you said a lot of don't follow Sundance's lead?
No, they do follow Sundance's lead. So, you know, films will be distributed pretty widely on the festival circuit, and the films that show at Sundance you'll see again and again at other festivals. But also, Sundance has been traditionally, you know, really great at finding new talent and launching new filmmakers, at finding new genres, and also looking at the kind of global film market and finding new hot areas.
We see, obviously, as you mentioned, very few films get selected to show at Sundance. And of those, a number do get picked up. But what happens to the ones that don't get picked up? They've got this sort of credential stamp for having been a Sundance film. How do they go about getting distributed?
So actually, distribution isn't always the end game for every film, although I'm sure everyone loves it. Many films are made really just for this festival circuit. And films can be made to influence policy or public opinion. They can be a labor of love. They could be a calling card for a production company or filmmaker hoping to fund future projects. They could just be a jumping off point for the speaker circuit. And then there is the kind of equivalent of self-publishing. So some films are released directly on VOD platforms like iTunes or Amazon, although you don't get marketing if you do it yourself. And then Vimeo actually has taken off as a way for films to be released by filmmakers who can then take control over how the films are monetized and distributed.
Every year, we see a certain number of major studio releases premiere at Sundance. And I know, like, some of the bigger theaters like the Eccles, you know, they on the first two nights are definitely showing some films that have already been picked up. Why does this happen? And is it effective?
Yeah, so the studio produced films don't show at Sundance. But as we were saying earlier, it can be hard to tell what's a studio film and what's an indie film. So one of the opening night films, just for example, when you finish Saving the World, it's Jesse Eisenberg's directorial debut. It stars Julianne Moore. It's actually produced by Emma Stone's company, Fruit Tree, distributed by and produced by A24, which is a great track record for Oscar winners. It brings a lot of celebrities to Main Street and some, you know, celebrity appeal and attention to the festival. So that's great for Sundance. And so even for these films that are likely to get distribution anyway, Sundance not only, you know, helps give it a kind of stamp of approval, but it really dramatically increases the amount that you can get in a distribution deal just by being at Sundance, but also by winning an award.
So when we see a premiere, they're not in the competition, which is I was trying to understand, you know, why not? In other words, do you understand what that distinction is between premieres? Because I always thought those were ones that were not technically independent and the competition films.
Yeah. So the competition films are definitely films that the programmers think are worthy of awards. But then they don't want to say no to a celebrity who brings a film or something that would also help bring some more attention to the festival. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they kind of allow films to be shown, and they're happy to have films that are shown at a competition because they're often popular favorites, but they're not considered in the same artistic category as the films that are in competition. It's a deal that kind of works for both. Mm-hmm.
I know this year, just as with last year, the Sundance Film Festival is a virtual only festival. Do you think the lack of an in-person festival is causing any significant effect on the business aspects? I know just watching people in town, whether they're at restaurants or on the bus or on the street, there is networking going on.
Yeah. So in many ways, the pandemic just accelerated a lot of changes to things happening online that were already in place. So pre-pandemic, for example, Sundance was really ahead of the game. They'd already launched their events and collaborative platform called CoLab. So it's actually not surprising, I think, that Sundance has done a really great job of the virtual festivals last year and this year, and it seems so this year. So last year, the fully virtual festival, producers created pre-tape material, and that took advantage of the kind of asynchronous opportunities to reach buyers. So that in some ways they could reach buyers who wouldn't have been able to come meet them in person and in the room. Sundance held virtual Q&As that again could be consumed asynchronously. And they also tried to create some kinds of social events. And they do a really highly produced wrap up. Most over 600,000 total audience views were achieved last year. But having said that, I think those impromptu conversations really make a difference. I spoke to one festival programmer last year and I said, isn't this great that 10 times more people saw the films than normally? And she said, no, the conversations people have standing in line are the real value of the festival. And that didn't happen. And I think she's right. And I think that the people that kind of suffer the most are new filmmakers, younger distribution companies. And so filmmakers and distributors who already have these relationships can get on a Zoom call or on the phone. But it is those kind of impromptu conversations where you can make contacts and broad network that aren't happening for newer filmmakers.
Certainly the line at Sundance is an experience that I think a lot of us are missing for the second year because so much interesting conversation happens in those lines. Having said that, we had the first weekend of Sundance this weekend. What did you see? What do you like? And what are you hearing?
So this is another effect of a virtual festival is you can now see much more. You're not constrained by the lines and getting your tickets. On the other hand, you can get distracted by other things and not see much, which is what's happened to me. But I've been reading it. I have been reading. And so I've actually been excited by the buzz around the film, the documentary Fire of Love, about two French volcano experts who fall in love and ultimately die. And that's actually a film that's been part of the first kind of big bidding war this year. Nat Geo acquired it for undisclosed seven figures. Also Rachel Lears, who made Knock Down the House, has a follow-up film where she follows Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez again. It's called To the End. Personally, I've been really excited by Amy Poehler's Lucy and Desi, especially because I was a little disappointed by Being the Ricardos, and I'm a Lucy fan.
I had the same reaction. It's funny you should say that. Have you seen the documentary yet?
I haven't, but definitely I will try to see it this week.
Okay.
Also, Netflix has a three-part film about Kanye West called Genius that I think just premiered last night. And if I read correctly, I think Kanye West already asked to recut it. But that probably won't happen because I think it's supposed to premiere on Netflix in the next 2 weeks.
I think that's a interesting piece where you said, you know, people are looking to have at least that three-part Kanye West piece debut within 2 weeks. How quickly do people or does, you know, the general audience get to see this? You mentioned Fire of Love, Nat Geo picked that up. Like, is that something I'm going to see on Disney Plus? Or some of these will be, not rising for a couple of months?
Yeah, so there are films that were bought last year at Sundance which still haven't been released. Actually, quite a few. In some sense, that's part of the pandemic, making theatrical releases a little bit unpredictable. But it's not completely unusual. And again, there's this whole range. So why would Netflix want to have a film premiere at Sundance? I mean, it's like just a great marketing tool. It's a lot of free publicity. But it also does give the film or TV show or miniseries just a kind of the imprimatur of the festival. The programmers think it's good enough to be shot at a festival, which is amazing for Netflix. It's the equivalent of go ahead.
No, go ahead. Peter, before we go,
I was saying it's like winning any award, like winning an Oscar. It actually does have a big bump in viewership.
Peter, before we go, I want to zoom out away from Sundance a little bit and talk about the future of movie theaters. I know that as we were in the run-up to Sundance, I noticed that local movie theaters are now open fewer days a week. They're now open fewer hours a day. What's your sense of where we're going to be post-pandemic in the world of exhibitions? Are we just going to be able to see, Spider-Man at the local theater and that's about it? And are we going to see a lot of screens closing? What's your sense?
Yeah, I mean, this is very hard to predict. And obviously, if the pandemic continues to unfold, things keep are moving up and down, and there's no linear progression. So I know for this that producers, studios have been looking to shorten windows and to get things on streaming platforms and video on demand faster. And with all of this vertical integration, so studios owning subscription services, the theatrical release isn't as important for generating revenue because they're looking to subscribers more than individual ticket sales. Although obviously they'd like to have both. And so I think if there are films that have like Spider-Man that have a tremendous amount of marketing where you can really drive people into the theater, those films obviously will still have the same kinds of theatrical windows. But then there have been a lot of surprises, I think, for the studios. So West Side Story seemed like a film that was going to have a large theatrical run and be successful, and then it turned out not to be.
It was wonderful.
I just think we'll have more options going forward. You might decide to go to the theater, but also the option to watch something at home for an inflated price. So, $20-$25, something that might look more like the price you would pay to bring a whole family into a theater.
We've been talking to Peter Desharnais about the business of Sundance. Peter, hopefully next year you'll get to be in the studio with us in person during Sundance Week. But we appreciate you taking the time to join us this morning.
The Prospector Square Property Owners Association continues to invest in improvements, highlighting the internal walkway with new white lighting and landscaping. In addition, three new restaurants and a new outside dining deck for one of its more popular dining establishments have added to the vibrancy of the area. Here to talk about their vision for the area is Craig Dennis, Executive Director of the Prospector Square Property Owners Association. Craig, thank you for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you. So glad to be here.
Oh, glad to have you. Let's start with a bit of background on Prospector Square. Prospector Square itself, the development in the area began in 1974. It does feature an interior walkway that many people aren't familiar with. Can you talk about what the original vision for the area was and how development has occurred since?
Well, Prospector Square is definitely a mixed-use community because we probably have the 64 buildings we have, about 10 are residential, and when I use the word residential, it's that even means a lot of different things, from condominiums to a full-service hotel. Barrett Lane, the walkway that you refer to down the center of Prospector Square, I think was always seen as a walkway to connect different parts of the community. But in hindsight, the Prospector Square community should have done a better job of having buildings open in the backside up to it. And in the future, we're trying to encourage that to happen. And as we move forward, we're trying to update Prospector Square so that the Barrett Lane part of our walkway gets connected to everything else through Park City.
You mentioned we mentioned in our introduction that there were three new restaurants that have opened in Prospector Square. Mm-hmm. What are they? Tell us a little. And are any of them like trying to take advantage of outdoor dining opportunities?
Well, Pretty Bird is about to open next week, and that's one of the three. And they will this summer have some outdoor dining on the sidewalk. And then the other we've had. Fuego's added a dining deck last summer that added about probably 30 seats to the back. And so that's been a nice addition for them. In addition, we've got the new juice bar that opened up. That's where right next to, it's where the beauty salon used to be in Lot H. And that's, and then Saltbox opened last year. Saltbox is a River Horse invention that is in the old Good Karma site. Saltbox has some nice outdoor dining as well.
So there's, you know, what we're seeing kind of reinvestment. And I want to get into a little bit as far as how Prospector Square may be different than a, something like Main Street, in that, you know, as the city looks to improve things, whether it be through for taxes or economic reasons, you know, they add improvements to an area. They look at doing streets and sidewalks and lights and landscaping. But with Prospector Square, it's not public property that's being improved. It's actually private property. So any type of investment is done internally.
Mostly, although the city's been pretty good working with us this last few years. Certainly, they rebuilt Prospector Avenue back in 2018. And for the city, that was a probably more than a $2 million project. And we tied in rebuilding a couple of our parking lots with that project. And then Lot G got rebuilt last year as well, which is where the new apartment complex went in and where the building that Pretty Bird's going to sit in. And then last year, we also got the city to put in a new rail trail connection off of Lot F, which is behind Freshies. And that's been a great addition for the city. That was probably a good $200,000 investment. And then this last year, we rebuilt Barrett Lane, a $350,000 investment for us from and just one block section, and the city, to their credit, put in a new crosswalk, basically connecting Barrett Lane right there at the Sheraton garage entrance. So the city's been very cooperative. We've made a point of doing walkthroughs with each of the city council persons. And in fact, I've got one scheduled this afternoon with our new city council person. And they've all been receptive. I think they all see Prospector Square as the go-to place now for the locals, since you know, parking can sometimes be a little tight up in Main Street. So, you know, Steve Joyce was our city council representative on our board. So we're going to be sort of curious who on the city council will be joining our board here in the next month or so.
Are there elements of the Prospector Square master plan that have not been completed, or that you're looking to build out in the next few years?
Oh, yes. We've spent about $1.75 million so far, and we've got another probably $4 to $6 million that we need to invest. And the big project I'm working on now is trying to figure out how do we raise additional funds from our members and how do we borrow that money. Basically, we need to spend $1 million on sewer improvements, $1 million on parking lot improvements, and the balance would be spent on upgrading Barrett Lane. As you mentioned, it was built in 1974, so a lot of the concrete is frankly showing its age. It's cracked in many spots, and we need to upgrade it. And so as we do each of these, we're also curious where the arts and culture district is going and how we connect to it, because we think it's key that we connect to the arts and culture district somehow. But yeah, we've got a lot more yet to do. The master plan was originally written in 2015. It's been updated. Allison was certainly involved with that project. She used to be executive director of this organization. So yep, we've got a lot more work yet to do.
You had mentioned, you know, one of the bigger projects in town, the Arts and Culture District, that is located just to the west of Prospector Square across Bonanza Drive. What's Prospector's kind of hopes and dreams for that area? What would be ideal for Prospector Square?
You know, we're going to leave that up to the city to decide. Our hopes, well, our concern is that we don't want to see ourselves become a park and ride area for the ski resorts. We have 1,100 parking stalls in Prospector Square. That said, we would like to see vibrancy of some type across the street. And during the planning process, the city came up with some nice looking connections, basically some nice bridges across the street, but they were very expensive, up to $15 million in cost. We'd love to see that, but we also concerned that we they would also take away 25 parking stalls in our lot I. So do we want to see a connection? Yes, we'd love to see some type of connection, be it probably underground, I would guess. But Bonanza is a key bottleneck there that does impede people getting across the street. And we want to see that. We want to see a connection there. Because we look at Prospector Square as an ideal way to get over the high school, the Echo Center, the Prospector community itself, and the rail trail. So anything that will improve connectivity, we're going to be behind.
You for sure mentioned kind of the hub or how Prospector Square is central to Park City. But we also talked about bottlenecks. You know, right now, Prospector Avenue right there at Bonanza Drive, as well as then Kearns and Sidewinder right by the 7-Eleven and the Instacare. Both of those intersections are hard intersections to navigate, and they're two key ones for Prospector Square. Is there any plans and development for improvements in those areas?
Not that I'm aware of yet, no. Something needs to be done long-term, though. It's definitely an issue.
Talk a little bit about some redevelopment that's going on now at the within the Prospector Square development. I understand that Black Diamond Ski Rental added a couple floors a couple of years ago. What other buildings are under redevelopment? What else do you see happening in the next couple of years?
Well, a couple things. Right now, there's a new building going up at right on Prospector Avenue at 1760. It's going to be a home automation center. It was interesting. They tore down what I considered a pretty nice-looking building and rebuilt a new building. I think you're going to see long-term. You have probably 10 buildings that are in Prospector Square. They're one story, and knowing what the property values are in Prospector Square and throughout the community, it could potentially be remodeled and torn down and rebuilt. Basically, we have what's called a 2.0 FAR from a planning standpoint, that you can pretty much have twice the square footage on the building lot. One of the things I probably should share with your listeners is Prospector Square is unique in Park City in the sense that the owners own their lots, but the Property Owners Association owns all the common area outside the lot. So we're responsible for all the landscaping, snow removal, and all the upkeep. We have five vacant lots, three of which are contiguous right off of Lot K. And one of the little interesting history tidbits is Lot K at one point was supposed to be a ice rink. That never came to be. A lot of lots got moved around back and replatted back in the day. But there's still the potential for some more building in Prospector Square as well. So long term, the Benson building right next to where I'm at, I'm in the Park Record building, is getting rebuilt as well. And so I would not surprise me to see some more building down the road here.
Do you expect that the existing health club, the big health club, will continue to operate as a health club, or do you think it'll end up being something else?
I don't know, but you bring up an interesting thing about where our geography lies. The health club is actually outside of the Prospector Square Property Owners Association. Yeah, we have 64 buildings, but where Intermountain is and where the Chamber is outside of Prospector Square, believe it or not. And Grubstake is within Prospector Square, but the other side of Gold Dust is not. So I'm not long-term, if you want that question. I hope it remains a health club for the sake of the community, but I don't know.
There's no guarantees on anything.
No, there isn't.
One thing or one trend that we've seen, I know that Park City Lodging has done this. I know that Black Diamond, when they increased their floor area and their height, residential above. And that's something as well. You know, there's a affordable housing complex right there in the same parking lot as Park City Lodging. And then I believe Ed Lewis parking lot G may have some additional stuff too. Do you see more permanent residents being a part of Prospector Square?
Probably. You bring up a good point. Like, Black Tie's got 6 units on top of it. And Park City Lodging itself has 3 units on top of it. Alberto's, most people don't know this, has 1 unit on top of it. And of course, Central Park is the city's affordable housing project. So yeah, probably in the long term, there could be, as the city looks at where to put their 800 unit goal, they certainly are aware of what's here. So would not surprise me to see more housing. We've got some interest, a lot of Airbnb type rentals. Carriage House has about 120 units, and of those 120 units, 20 are full-time and the rest are rentals. So it's amazing. There are a lot of overnight rentals just in Prospector Square.
Very true. So what recommendations do you have for people to learn and to explore more about Prospector Square? Let's say someone's never noticed the interior walkway or hasn't really walked around and seen what's available. How would you recommend someone, explore the area?
I would encourage them to start down at Gold Dust, right next to Grubstake, and walk up to the 3-4 blocks past the Sheraton. They'd go past Salt Box, and they'd end up about where Alberto's and Clockwork Cafe are. That would be a really nice walk of about 4 blocks. I would encourage them to feel free to park over in Lot G, which is next to Sun Creek, and you've got a rail connection there, rail trail connection. So there's lots of ways to walk through Prospector Square. You could drop into the Sheraton, who typically has music on Friday and Saturdays from 4 to 7, as a good spot to walk, a stop by. So there's lots of opportunity here.
Well, we appreciate the background. We appreciate learning all the new things that are happening. We've just spent some moments with Craig Dennis. He's the executive director of the Prospector Square Property Owners Association. Craig, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
A prominent fixture in Park City's fine dining scene and previously located on historic Main Street, Tupelo Park City opened its doors in its brand new home at 1500 Kearns Boulevard, formerly Adolph's, in December to serve eager locals and guests. Co-owner and chef Matthew Harris is an authentic practitioner of the principles of slow food and farm-to-table cuisine and joins us this morning to talk about Tupelo's comeback. Matt, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me. How are you?
We're doing great today. I'm glad to hear your voice. So let's start at the beginning of this transition. March 2020 is when a lot of locals would remember Tupelo, and that would be, you were located here on Main Street.
Yes.
But then there was the pandemic, and a few months later, the restaurant was no longer at this location. What happened?
So we were at the end of our lease at that point, and we just, like everybody else, we had no idea what was going on with the pandemic. So we decided not to renew our lease on that property at 508 Main.
And that was, I think, probably, a move that many restaurant owners didn't even have as an option.
Correct. Yeah, it just came straight down to timing. We had that option, so we were like, let's just pump the brakes here and see what happens. So you can kind of call it good timing or bad timing.
Either way, it gave you opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So Tupelo's new location is on Kearns Boulevard. Many people here in Park City would know it as the location of the former Adolph's restaurant. How did you come across the opportunity to locate in this space?
So we came across that probably back in June of last year. And we actually just kind of happened by it. It's not something we really planned, but we were kind of hoping to find somewhere on Main Street to relaunch Tupelo. But this location just came in, presented itself, and we were like, yeah, we think that this could be a fantastic location for Tupelo. Off Main Street, of course, but we thought it could be fantastic.
What types of opportunity does this new space bring to you? I know I'm actually able to look at 508 outside our studio window. You know, you had three floors. It don't appear that you had like a lot of outdoor dining. What does this new space allow you to do?
So the new space has absolutely a fantastic outdoor dining. We could probably have 60 to 70 people out on the patio. So we're super stoked about that. It gives us a lot of opportunity there. We have close to the same seating capacity as we did at 508 Main. But we have that patio and we have a tremendous amount of parking, which is fantastic.
The old Tupelo facility was a very desirable spot for, you know, private kinds of functions like wedding receptions and things like that. What kind of a facility, what kind of accommodations for functions like that can you offer at the new facility?
So at the new facility, it's actually fantastic because the way that the floor plan and the way it's broken up, we can offer groups of 25, 50, 35. We can really break the space up, which gives us the flexibility of hosting all kinds of events, whether small or large.
So let's talk about the food, because I know that's kind of the key piece to any good restaurant, especially Tupelo. What can people expect when dining at Tupelo?
So they can expect some of the traditional classics that we had at the original Tupelo, but we're kind of just, again, always changing and focusing on new ingredients, new producers. So you can expect some of the traditional stuff from Tupelo, but also we're doing all kinds of new stuff with the spin there.
Can you give us an example of a couple of new things that we might see on the menu that we wouldn't have seen on Main Street?
So, yeah, for sure. We have a braised pork cheek with shredded turnips and pickled radish. We one of the traditional ones are the classic ones. We have the elk bolognese, which is a fan fare. Right now on the menu, we have a seared foie gras, which traditionally wasn't on the menu. So we're definitely changing it up a bit.
I know that finding a seat in any restaurant in town is a difficult thing this winter, especially on busy weekends. What secrets can you give to people trying to dine at Tupelo? So what days of the week are you open? What are your hours? And can we get reservations?
So we're open 7 days a week. My suggestion would be to ski really hard all day and come in and eat early. You know, we open our doors at 5 o'clock. And so that would be my suggestion. And that goes for anywhere on Main Street or anywhere in town, is ski hard all day and eat early.
And just so our listeners know, is there a website that you can access your reservation system? Is it your website or one of the open table type places?
You can go to our website. It's TupeloParkCity.com, or you can access through Resy.
And Tupelo's not the only, it's not your only game in town. Talk to us a little more about what else you guys do here in the Park City area.
So we actually manage and run all the food outlets and concepts at the St. Regis. So you have Rhyme, the Brasserie, Terrace Cafe, and the Vintage Room. And we also have a little spot for, it's kind of secret. People are kind of going to be mad at me for talking about it, but it's a little secret spot up by the gondola called Rhyme Raw Bar. And we specialize in lobster rolls, oysters, shrimp cocktail, and you just kind of dip in there, and it's kind of just this little haven for people that know about it. And that's at the top of the gondola in Deer Valley.
So lots of places.
Yeah. Yeah, we own or operate four or five places around town. So
you're able to kind of play with the different types of cuisine and different types of food. One question that I do want to make sure that our listeners know, is there a bar at the new location? Can someone come in for a drink and an appetizer?
There is a bar at the new location. We're actually getting it kind of finished up right now. We're putting up some glass paneling and stuff, and that'll be done by the end of the week. But there is absolutely a bar with fantastic cocktails.
Fantastic. We're always looking for new places here in town. Well, we've had the opportunity to speak with Matt Harris. He is the chef and co-owner of Tupelo Park City. They've just reopened here at 1500 Kearns Boulevard. We're happy to have you here today. Matt, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.